Thank you both. It's always the hardest role as the chair because we have these fantastic speakers on incredibly important topics, and we want to hear everything from them, and somehow we're supposed to keep them to time and make time for questions and comments from the audience, which we very much want to. So we have time for a couple questions. I'd ask if anybody has a burning question, come up to the mic. Please make them short questions so somebody else can get a question in, and then we're going to go to the break, and I'm going to ask the speakers to stay up here so the people who haven't had a chance to ask a question can ask them personally, one-on-one.
With all due respect to our distinguished speakers, I would suggest they've been dealing with symptoms rather than causes of inequality. To oversimplify, perhaps, I would suggest that it is social environments that encourage social Darwinism, which explain a lot of the problem. The belief by many individuals and groups that their superiority allows them privileges in the world, whereas those that are disadvantaged have no one to blame but themselves because of their ignorance, stupidity, incompetence, etc. And it seems to me that this is the root cause which allows all of these inequities to really happen and take many forms. So the question that I'm asking is, how does one overcome this basic value system, which seems to me to be the root of a lot of what we're talking about?
Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to you, too. Hopefully that mic is live for any comments you want to make.
Is this live? Yeah. Supporting the urban poor to organize, to make changes, to negotiate, to change their relationship with local government is not addressing the symptoms, it's addressing the causes. All the great environmental health innovations have largely been around organizations of the urban poor, associated with those that support them, building social movements to demand change. I don't see that as symptoms. I see that as addressing causes.
What I would suggest, though, their limited success, just for clarification, I'm suggesting their limited success, as remarkable as it may be, but the limited success on a global level is due to the fact that the people who are decision makers tend to have this value system based on inequality. And they will grant minor reforms, but they will not challenge their own privileged positions of their group or their society.
Bill.
Almost tongue-in-cheek, I don't know if you have read Ireland by Huxley, but this is a solution that took them generations to achieve. They had to change the way children were educated and get them to see the world differently. That's a big task, and it was an ideal world where it happened. But I wonder if it was mentioned, I think, this morning again, that there are examples of where things have worked, and the example that keeps coming up it wouldn't apply everywhere, but was the one of cigarette smoking and the success that's come against the establishment and the wishes of the establishment to sell more cigarettes and make profits, in spite of the fact that it was causing so much death and misery. And there were a couple, I see a couple of things that happened, and if I go to what Dr. El Arignani said that I quoted, one was that the bottom, there were people who were determined and didn't give up and weren't afraid to challenge the system. And they kept on going. They were joined by the scientific community and the medical community who reinforced their ways. And then it took the leadership of the Surgeon General of the United States, where the breakthrough took place, to stand up and tell her government that this is the way things should be. And then it happened. And since then, the increase that's come, the momentum is there, and now there are pictures on cigarettes that discourage others that would take up smoking. But it's an example, it's of leadership and the bottom working together, and I think that's what will make it happen.
Thank you. We have one more person at the mic. We'll take that, and then I'm going to pass it over to Tinka.
This is a question for David, actually. I'm wondering what your thoughts are, or if you had experience with empowering local communities in post-war, post-civil war countries or regions where in the same community you have members who belong to different militias, who have different religions. Are there examples of communities who were able to transcend these issues and learn to work together into a transparent bidding process to develop a wastewater treatment plan or a school? Or are there also communities where, well, caution must be taken and maybe you shouldn't trust the local community? Thanks.
I have no experience, but the federations do. The federations from South Africa, from Kenya, were asked to Sierra Leone to help support women savings groups there in the rebuilding of a nation. In Angola, too, after the terrible civil war, the women's savings groups in the informal settlements invited women's savings groups from other federations. So the beauty of the work of all these federations is that it's all done autonomously outside academics, outside NGOs, outside international agencies. They do it themselves. And every year I try and spend time in maybe three of these federations, there's always 1,000 times more going on than's been documented and that I can actually get a handle on. I'm sure there's lots more examples that I don't know.
In the spirit of working at all levels, as we think about moving to the break, I just want to challenge you to do two things. You're going to hear from Tinka about what the poster presentations are going to be. You'll hear 1 minute quick summary so you know what you can go see. For those of you who have already seen the posters or who want to be talking to colleagues, I hope you'll take the two challenges we heard seriously. In terms of the MDGs, here's the only thing I would say. The current MDGs expire in 2015. We all know we won't have reached them. On the other hand, setting them meant more progress was made towards these goals. A lot of people worked hard to make movement towards them. Getting water, climate change, other aspects of the environment, housing, sanitation into the next round would be critically important. People are starting to talk about the next round now because they know there will be new goals in 2015. So I hope during the break you're going to think about how you can influence them and how you'd want to influence them. On getting money directly to community-based organizations, Canada recently committed $1.5 billion in new dollars to maternal, newborn, and child health. Okay, I can do this math. 1% would be $15 million to organizations. It'd be fantastic if women's savings organizations got $15 million of that. So I also hope during the break we'll take David's challenge seriously about what it means to start getting every country some portion of that aid directly to groups. So I'd like to thank the speakers and ask you to stay here 1 minute while Tinka comes up and tells you about the break.
So I'm delighted to introduce our policy fellows who will be presenting results from their case studies during two poster sessions today. Our policy fellows work with IHSP during a one-year training and research program, and last summer, each one traveled around the globe to conduct an intensive case study on an organization or a program doing innovative work on increasing environmental equity. Several hundred interviews and transcriptions later, they've analyzed their data and they're ready to share their findings. So just to give you a quick roadmap of what's waiting outside in the lobby, I'm going to ask each fellow to stand while I mention your case study. If you're interested in learning about a range of compelling green job training programs in North America, several fellows conducted research in Vancouver, New York. So stand, meet you, I think. Vancouver, New York. It's Kara. Oakland and Austin. Another fellow studied an exciting green economy and job creation program in Cleveland. In Latin America, a fellow examined a community-focused slum upgrading project in Medellin, while across the ocean, another fellow looked at long-term urban renewal processes in Sweden. And finally, please come learn about two innovative projects in India and Bangladesh, one about sustainable transportation, and another about waste management. Our fellows are eager to share their findings as well as hear about your questions and your feedback. I know you'll enjoy the presentations. Thank you. So we now invite you to go take a break, get some coffee. Just as a little reminder, our next sessions are going to be breakout sessions. So we're going to be splitting. So if you have a blue dot on your name tag, you'll be participating in panel one, which will be here in this room, which is on addressing basic needs, water and food. And if you have a yellow dot on your name tag, you will be in panel two, which is in Salon Printemps, which when you exit is just to your left around the corner. And that panel will be on the built environment, land use, transportation, and housing. So enjoy your break, and we'll see you back at 10:30.
If we don't have a dot, we have a choice. If we don't have a dot, we have a choice.